Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, St. Thomas Aquinas, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 3.
Despite his central concern with God, Thomas doesn't think that God's existence is self-evident. Thomas had great confidence in the capacities of human reason, yet he would not agree with St. Anselm or Descartes that God's existence can be proven directly from our concept of a most perfect being. Thomas does think, though, that our experience of the physical world holds enough traces of God's presence to provide the basis for a proof. This proof will lead us to the knowledge that God exists, and it can give us some hints about his nature. In approaching the question of God's existence, Thomas anticipates two objections that complicate any attempt to prove that there is a God. First of all, there's the problem that evil exists. The two world wars of the 20th century suggest that the problem of evil may loom larger today than it did in Thomas's time. But Thomas's readers knew plague and pillage, fire and famine all too well, as we still do today. Betrayal, brutality, rape and murder are common to his time and ours. How then can any reasonable man suggest that there's a divine, benevolent being who creates and governs this world? The objector answers in words too calm for the bewilderment and anguish that lie beneath them.
It seems that there is no God, because if one of two contraries be infinite, the other would be altogether destroyed. But the name God means that which is infinite goodness. If, therefore, God existed, there would be no evil discoverable. But there is evil in the world. Therefore, God does not exist.
That's the question. Either there is God and no evil, or evil and no God. How can a good, all-powerful God stand idle while the work of his hand is wrecked and his creatures suffer? Would not nothingness be better than so much misery, the pain of the world, pain we all know? The second question is different. It stands on the pride of human reason, on the idea that science is self-sufficient. Science sets out to provide a rational account of the world in terms of principles and laws based on human experience. The natural sciences explain the physical world, and the social sciences explain human nature. The existence of God is irrelevant. Nature and society suffice. There's no need to go beyond them to account for our experience. The objector complains,
"It is superfluous to suppose that what can be accounted for by a few principles has been produced by many. But it seems that everything we see in the world can be accounted for by other principles, supposing God did not exist. For all natural things can be reduced to one principle, which is nature, and all voluntary things can be reduced to one principle, which is human reason or will. Therefore, there is no need to suppose God's existence."
The principle of economy applies here. In explaining things, we appeal to no more causes than are necessary. This tactic has been called Occam's razor. We must shave down our arguments to their most simple and direct components. Anyone today could say that science does a good enough job. Left alone, it'll do better still. The rationalist says there's no need to appeal to some mysterious source beyond the world to explain what happens in it. Don't reach for what lies beyond our grasp. Be content with what we can know. A bird in the hand, half a loaf. These are better than none. The first objection demands all or nothing. The second asks, if not all, why not at least something? Thomas answers from the Bible, "I am who am." He understood that to be the name of God. He turns to the philosophers to answer the question, does God exist? Thomas constructs one overall proof, but he presents five versions of it. His result goes far beyond the pagan Greek philosophers. Thomas insists on beginning with concrete things rather than abstract ideas.
Human knowledge is derived from sensible objects.
So all five ways of proving God's existence begin with first-hand, sensible experience, but each way has a different starting point in experience. These ways are not original with Thomas. The first is drawn directly from Aristotle, the second from the Arab philosopher Avicenna, The third is from the Jewish thinker Moses Maimonides. The fourth, ultimately, from Plato by way of St. Augustine. And the fifth, and most popular, seems to have been drawn from a Greek church father, St. John Damascene, though it was widespread among both Christian and pagan authors. Thomas's five ways compose almost a miniature of his intellectual background. His arguments are not entirely new, but they're modified and deepened in very important ways. As we'll see in more detail, the first way to prove God's existence starts from the fact that things are in motion. The second way starts with the fact that one thing acts upon another. The third proof begins with the fact that none of the things in our experience, neither you nor I nor any other thing, exists by absolute necessity. It's quite conceivable that we might never have existed at all. The fourth proof begins with the fact that things differ in respect to various qualities, some being more or less good, some more or less meaningful, more or less beautiful. And in the fifth way, we observe that things usually act according to regular patterns which reflect some intelligence or order. Each way is meant to bear its own weight. As spokes of a wheel, all five converge on a common center. Yet the five together are meant to provide the mind with the basis for further knowledge of God. We should point out in passing that these famous five ways are not the same as the three later proofs of God that have been attacked by David Hume, Immanuel Kant, and other modern philosophers. These later proofs were to become current in 18th century textbooks, and they reflect the more modern rationalist and idealist presuppositions of the Enlightenment. Let's look in detail at the first of Thomas's five ways of proving God's existence. The first way is sometimes called the argument from motion. It's so important in philosophical history that we should spend some time developing it. Then we'll be able to see by example how Thomas would develop his other four ways. He begins,
"The first and most manifest way is the argument from motion. For it is certain and evident to our senses that in the world some things are in motion."
Thomas has begun with what he takes to be the easiest starting point. It's obvious, undeniable, that things move and change. You can wave your hand to prove that, or look at the setting sun. It's worth noting that for this first proof, we don't need to agree with the Greek philosopher Heraclitus that all things change. It's enough to find one single thing in motion and to ask what that means. But you have to do more than wave your hand to establish the existence of God. We have to determine the conditions where movement takes place. To do that, Thomas takes a not-so-small first step from observation to analysis. He takes up concepts he's learned from Aristotle.
"Now, whatever is moved by another."
But this, of course, requires an explanation.
"Nothing can be moved, except it is, in potentiality, to that towards which it is moved. Whereas a thing moves, inasmuch as it is actual."
This follows from the understanding of movement that Thomas shares with Aristotle.
"For motion is nothing else than the reduction of something from potentiality to actuality."
This argument will be a little plainer if we reshuffle the statements. The movement of anything is the passage from something potential to something actual. But that passage can't take place unless a movement is caused by something independent of the thing that moves. And so whenever we see something in motion, we can know it's been moved by something else. Your hand waves, but you make it wave. Thomas's analysis makes explicit a common fact of our experience, the distinction between being and becoming. For example, there's a difference between being a good musician and having the ability to become a good musician. Water can become hot only if it's first not hot, and yet is able to be hot. And, of course, experience teaches us that different things have different capacities appropriate to them. It's natural to wonder why philosophers ponder such obvious facts. For Thomas, that's philosophy's job, to think about facts and situations in order to produce general conclusions about the origin, nature, and purpose of such facts. Philosophical conclusions challenge us to think deeply and critically about unfamiliar aspects of the familiar things about us. Thomas has learned from Aristotle that because movement is very smooth and fluid, it's the most difficult notion for the mind to attend to. The mind loves to pin things down, especially by naming, classifying, measuring them. But in this instance, our attention is directed to the passage itself. When water is heated, it's on the way from one state to another. Aristotle asked, what is operating here? Three things, he said. First, there's the common substrate, he said, the portion of water that undergoes the change and survives in the result. Second, there's an initial privation or lack, the water's absence of heat. And finally, there's a new actuation, the influx of heat into the water as it comes to a boil. This is all well enough, but the important point is this. The change itself is neither the water nor its cold state, nor the fire. The change itself is mere fluidity, a pure passage. Change is none of the above factors. It's their transformation. Some factors, such as the cold state, pass away. Others, such as the water itself, remain, more or less, throughout the entire process of being transformed. If we can accept the story so far, then we should accept the next point. Whatever is moved by another. With an eye to Aristotle, who would have nodded in agreement, Thomas continues.
But nothing can be reduced from potentiality to actuality except by something in a state of actuality.
And Thomas gives us an example.
Thus, that which is actually hot as fire makes wood, which is potentially hot, to be actually hot, and thereby moves and changes it.
Anything that changes must be acted upon by something else. Otherwise, we have a logical contradiction. For example, water cannot heat itself. If it could, it would have to be simultaneously and actually both hot and cold.
Now, it is not possible that the same thing should be at once in actuality and potentiality in the same respect, but only in different respects. For what is actually hot cannot simultaneously be potentially hot, but it is simultaneously potentially cold. It is therefore impossible that in the same respect and in the same way a thing should be both mover and moved, that is, that it should move itself. Therefore, whatever is moved must be moved by another.
Thomas's students might well have objected here that they'd all moved their own feet to get to his lecture. Indeed, Thomas himself distinguishes living from non-living things precisely on the ground that the living are able to move themselves. Plants move themselves by growth and nutrition. Higher animals move themselves by locomotion and perception. But Thomas thinks that a living thing moving itself does not contradict the principle that all things in motion are moved by yet another mover. Within a complex organism, Thomas distinguishes the moving center of animal life, the vital soul, from the members and organs which are moved by it. The animal as a whole does move itself in walking, but it moves itself by one part, the soul, moving other parts, the members and organs. In Thomas's view, we must then account for what moves the soul. Again, we might ask, why is such a fuss being made over what's so obvious to our common sense? But it's important for Thomas that we not simply rest the case upon ordinary sense observation. Analyzing motion in terms of actuality and potentiality is meant to probe more deeply into the nature of motion and to show what necessarily operates within it. This requires us to follow the analysis wherever it may lead us, even if it leads us beyond motion to God as unmoved mover.
This is the end of part 3. Please download part 4 to continue.